Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Purely as an investor, Warren Buffett is a superstar. Since the 1960s, his returns have been legendary, far outpacing the markets year after year. But Buffett has been more than a giant moneymaker. He's been the reassuring, straight-shooter face of American investor capitalism in years when reassurance was in short supply. Now he's 80. His likely successor just quit under a cloud. This hour on Point, Warren Buffett at 80. And what, who comes next? Joining me now is Roger Lowenstein, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. He's a longtime financial journalist and author of the best-selling biography, Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist. His latest book, The End of Wall Street, is just out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, it's a pleasure, as always, to be on your show.
It's great to have you with us. And here we are talking about Warren Buffett. He's 80 years old. He's come to stand for a lot. He's very, very focused on reputation throughout his career, quoted on it again and again on how precious reputation is. I guess for many Americans, his reputation is too big to be rocked. But in the last week, Roger, at least when it comes to the succession front, it's been kind of a tough week for Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway. Tell us the story of what's happened with his the guy that many people have seen as his successor in waiting, David Sokol.
Yeah, it's really very, very distressing for Buffett watchers, for Buffett admirers, of whom there are many, for Buffett shareholders, of which I'm one, I should say. What happened was it came out, Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett's company, the company he's the biggest shareholder of, recently bought a company called Lubrizol. And what Buffett announced was that one of his senior executives, who runs a number of other Berkshire's other companies, a man named David Sokol, had brought this idea to him back in December and suggested that Berkshire buy Lubrizol, and at the same time bought some stock in Lubrizol. And actually, the amount of stock he bought was $10 million worth, which Buffett apparently didn't learn till much later. The deal finally closed in March, and when it did close, that is to say, when Berkshire bought this other company, Lubrizol, Buffett's executive, David Sokol, earned an extra $3 million by virtue of the amount that his Lubrizol stock rose. When this news came out, which is about nearly a week ago now, it was announced that Sokol had resigned. But what I think is, you know, really given pain to many Buffett watchers who regarded him, as you said in your prologue, not just as an investment guru, but as a sort of moral beacon on Wall Street, a place where morality is often in short supply, is that there's been no statement from Warren that what he did was wrong, what Sokol did was wrong. And in fact, he's refused to say that this is why Sokol left or resigned. He merely said, released a very bland statement, which was that Sokol himself had said, and Buffett had concluded also, that neither thought that Sokol had violated the law. And I must tell you, Tom, that brought me immediately back to a statement that Buffett had made some 20 years ago when he was rescuing an investment bank, Salomon Brothers, which had been subject to a scandal, not one that Buffett had been involved in at all. And he said, it's not going to be enough for employees at Salomon to be inside the line of the law. Our employees have to be way, way, way away from the line. And it was that idea that here was a company, even on Wall Street, where the standard wasn't going to be, you know, one where if 18 lawyers looked at it in the right direction, it would pass legal muster. But they were truly going to be, you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, ethical. And to hear him sort of parse the truth in this way, and to just rest on a statement that, well, there doesn't seem to have been any violation of the law, it's been very disappointing.
Now, it's so interesting to look at. It can sound like real inside baseball to a lot of people, and yet here's the guy who's supposed to stand for the squeaky, clean approach to the American economic system, Roger. And he has said in the past, one of his favorite sayings, lose money for my firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless. And yet he's been kind of patting David Sokol kindly on the back as he has indeed left Berkshire Hathaway, but off he goes.
Yeah, he made that comment about losing a shred of reputation in that same Solomon Brothers episode in 1991. And there's no doubt that David Sokol has lost, I would say, more than a shred of reputation for Berkshire Hathaway, and frankly, more than a shred of reputation for Warren Buffett. Now, we should hasten to add that the question of ethics or violation of ethics isn't on behalf of Buffett himself. Buffett didn't make any profit on this transaction other than the proportional gain that might accrue or will accrue to any shareholder. It's his unwillingness to bluntly critique David Sokol and to say, hey, one of my guys did wrong, and this is why, in whatever form, I've ensured that he leave the company. Now, we'll give him credit because within 10 days after the news came out, Sokol was gone.
But to understand, just to get the picture here, I mean, this is Sokol. He buys about $10 million worth of stock in this company, Lubrizol, in January. And just a couple days later, he's pitching a takeover of that company to Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway. Of course, when Berkshire Hathaway buys a company, its stock goes up. That's exactly what happens. David Sokol makes $3 million in a matter of days. And off he goes. You know, if this had been elsewhere in the universe of high finance or even medium finance here, Roger, it wouldn't be that much of a blip. But it's because it's around Warren Buffett, and he's supposed to stand for something in a time when so much of the reputation of Wall Street has just been in tatters.
Yes, I think that's why it really hurts. Again, we don't really know the the truth of why Sokol left. Buffett has presented it as a resignation that he didn't prompt. And he very, craftily said that Sokol said it had nothing to do with his stock purchase.
He wanted to spend more time with his family and on philanthropy.
Yeah. Everybody has a family. When people quit, 10 days after a scandal like this breaks, you can bet no philanthropy is that pressing. What we don't know is Buffett has also said he went off to India just before this happened, and just at the time he learned that Sokol's purchases were major. Back in January, when he first agreed to pursue the deal, Sokol told him he owned stock, and Buffett didn't pursue the matter further. I say didn't ask him when he'd bought the stock, didn't ask if it was a significant stock purchase. I tell you, I think that's credible. And at the time when the deal was done, which is the first part of March, it's just this past March, it was then that Buffett found out, and the chief financial officer of Berkshire came to him and said, hey, this guy bought $10 million of stock. It wasn't a little dalliance. And he bought it right at the time at which he was telling Berkshire's investment banker, which is Citigroup, yes, Berkshire may be interested in Lubrizol. Let's tell Lubrizol Berkshire may want to get together with him and so on. So it looks far from innocent. What we don't know is whether Buffett gave Sokol to know in one way or another that his resignation would be, shall we say, more than welcome, in which case he didn't fail to act. He's merely then failed to say to the public, frankly, yes, I had him go. And he's also failed to say what we all would long to hear, which is this is not behavior that's acceptable at Berkshire Hathaway. This is not far, far away from the line, and that's why he no longer works here. That's what Warren Buffett's fans are still yearning to hear, and they haven't heard it.
Warren Buffett's been out in the world giving advice, sharing his perspective on business and investing as he has for years. He's had the credibility to do that because his reputation has been pretty high. His record has been tremendous. Here he was at a press conference in Bangalore in India last month, reiterating his lifelong investment philosophy to a new generation, a new realm of Indian investors.
My advice to Indian investors would be the same as I would say in any country. Invest in what you understand. Don't get outside of what I call your circle of competence. Don't try and buy and sell actively. I don't know how to do it, and I know very few people that do. Basically, buy into businesses where you feel that they have some kind of a sustainable economic advantage over time, where you feel good about the management, and where you're not paying too high a price to make the purchase. And that's what I've been doing all my life, and it works okay.
And then he comes back and he's up against this kind of headline from CNBC's Kudlow report.
Breaking news. The man widely seen to take over for Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway, David Sokol, suddenly resigns from the company. This after he bought shares in a company he encouraged Buffett to acquire.
Roger Lowenstein joins us. He's a biographer of Warren Buffett. What does Warren Buffett stand for when it comes to how Americans look at the system within which we all work and hope to survive?
You know, I think he stands for the idea that beyond every share on Wall Street, behind every security, behind all the complexity, it's really all just about businesses. And you have to look at these shares of stock and these bonds and these complicated securities and CDOs. They're not any better or any worse than the real-time businesses, the real-life businesses behind them. And if you can think of them that way and invest in them that way as businesses, not as, you know, little numbers on a ticker tape or something, you'll do better. But I want to get to something in that tape you played, because he said that he sticks to his circle of competence, which is his phrase for saying he sticks to what he's good at, and he looks for competent management. And that phrase is today particularly pregnant with more meaning than people may realize. Buffett looks for competent management because, as he's often said and always demonstrated, he's not very good at replacing it. In fact, if he has a weakness, and I think he does have a weakness, and I think it's been brought out, he is very, very, very chary of confrontation. He does not like to criticize. He'll criticize business practices, and he does so every year, but doesn't do so by name, doesn't like to call people on the carpet, really has lived his life in such a way as to avoid confrontation, and looks, when he buys businesses, to buy businesses that are run by people who will be there a long, long time. And his philosophy has sort of been, look, if I make a mistake, I'm stuck with it. He does not sell the business and doesn't cashier.
Roger, stand by there. This is On Point. We're talking about Warren Buffett. We'll be right back. Here's the sound of David Sokol, who resigned last week. Many had seen him as the successor to Buffett, who is now 80. He appeared on CNBC's Squawk Box Thursday morning, claimed it was luck and circumstance that Berkshire Hathaway announced plans to acquire the chemical company Lubrizol just a couple of months after he bought about $10 million in its shares. He maintained he'd done nothing wrong.
Knowing today what I know, what I would do differently is I just would never have mentioned it to Warren and just made my own investment and left it alone. I think that's a disservice to Berkshire, but I don't think you can ask executives to not invest their own family's capital in a company that Berkshire had no interest or even knowledge of, and somehow police that.
But it's got a lot of people thinking twice about Warren Buffett and that legacy that at some point he's going to have to leave. We're going to hear in just a moment from Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary of the USA. Roger Lowenstein is with us, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, columnist for Bloomberg News, biographer of Warren Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist. His latest book is The End of Wall Street, just out in paperback. We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Roger, just remind us of the record, how Warren Buffett got this status. You know, there are a lot of people who have made a lot of money off him, a lot more who've never made a dime. But the returns that he brought in with Berkshire Hathaway year after year were so head-turning. Just give us a sense of that.
Tom, way back in the early 60s, he invested in a then textile company that had one factory in New Bedford, Massachusetts. It was Berkshire Hathaway. And the stock was in the teens. He was unhappy with the management and eventually bought control of the company. That was 1965. He's run the company ever since. By the way, the stock then was $18 per share. And once he'd gotten control of the company, he realized that the real problem with the company was that it was in a very bad business. Textiles, of course, all the textile mills to speak of in that part of the country have shut down. As the business was winding down, he began to squeeze out profits and divert them into other investments, into insurance, and bought a candy business, bought a newspaper, bought a steel mill. And from reinvesting that money, which all came from the dying profits of his dying textile business, he created an empire today worth $125,000 for each share, up from $18 a share.
Sort of what, $130, $40 billion overall he's now investing?
A couple hundred billion dollars. The company's worth. He's worth, yes, $40 billion, thereabouts. And, you know, to go from $18 a share to $125,000 a share over that period of time. He's really the Babe Ruth of investing. We're talking about 45 years. It's unparalleled, and I don't think we'll ever see it again.
But here's the thing that it's left me thinking, and I guess the reason we're talking about it today, that success is a super scale. But it was the sense of a man of integrity doing that I think has kept a lot of people buying in to the extent that people are still bought in, even as Wall Street's reputation was just being absolutely shredded. And you've written about that, Roger. When things were really rocking, he'd be out front. He came in just after the meltdown and bought a big stake in Goldman Sachs when it was really in trouble. Now, he made a ton of money on that. But he's kind of, if there's anybody who's been settling the boat, it's been Warren Buffett. And now, I don't know.
Yes, the tape you just played of Sokol, where he said, "How could you expect me not to invest my family's capital in a stock Berkshire Hathaway hadn't heard about?" That's really a complete lie, because he heard about Lubrizol in his capacity as a Berkshire executive. He met with some Citigroup executives who were pitching to him some potential takeover targets for Berkshire. They weren't talking to him because he was David Sokol.
Mm-hmm.
They were talking to him because he represented Berkshire. And for him to buy the stock first for his own, $10 million worth for his own behalf, it's just a reprehensible abuse. And for Buffett either to not see it or to not critique it, it's just inexplicable to those of us who followed him. Explicable, not defensible, but explicable only by what I said before. He does not like to criticize, and particularly people in his own orbit. But I can't defend it, and it's...
Trouble right there for Warren Buffett, and maybe trouble in terms of credibility in our system. I mean, at some point, he's going to be gone here. Who's going to stand out front and speak up with a reputation for integrity if it's not Warren Buffett? Roger Lowenstein, stand by. It's great to have you with us. I want to welcome you to our conversation right now from Berkeley, California, Robert Reich, former U.S. Labor Secretary under President Clinton, now professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley, author of Aftershock, The Next Economy, and America's Future. Robert Reich, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
Robert Reich, we here, Roger Lowenstein aside, are not shareholders in Berkshire Hathaway. That's not the world we run in. But when you look at Warren Buffett, he's had a lot to do with keeping a kind of a straight shooter face, to the extent that there is that face, on American investor capitalism, which has been so active in these recent decades. And the trouble, I don't know how big or small it is right now, but he's 80 years old, and here he's got this trouble on the successor front. And it leaves you thinking, who's going to stick up, stand up, be out front for this system that has become the target of so much criticism, so much of it justified, if not Warren Buffett? I mean, who's going to be the front man for this, Bob, if it's not Warren Buffett?
I don't know either, Tom. And one of the sad things about this is that Warren Buffett, as you mentioned before, has been a moral beacon in an industry that otherwise has been very, very tarnished. I mean, 3 years ago, as everybody remembers, the financial sector melted down and taxpayers bailed it out. And now major banks and financiers across this country, particularly on Wall Street, are back to where they were before, doing as well. But most of the rest of us are still in the wake of what they did. So that moral, the moral center, the integrity that Warren Buffett has represented, not only in his own dealings, but also living very modestly in Omaha, Nebraska, the sage of Omaha, and devoting so much of his fortune to charity, and being someone who was a spokesman and has been a spokesman for the world of finance, and reassured Americans that maybe finance was not all that bad. You didn't have to compromise your integrity if you went into finance. Suddenly, this man himself is in danger of being tarnished.
And where does that leave us? I mean, I'm looking here. You know, we've got listeners, Robert Reich, Roger Lowenstein, responding online. You know, here's one on Facebook who says, "Buffett's an exceptional human. He's above the fray for now." Here's another who says, "Buffett isn't perfect, but he's certainly one of the good guys. Compare him to Lloyd Blankfein, Goldman Sachs, Richard Fuld. I'd say he's near perfect." What do you say, Bob?
Well, he's not near perfect. I mean, I think that there are obviously some blemishes. Roger was pointing out some of the issues before. But I think the most important thing about Warren Buffett is that he has always stood for a very important principle, and that is that in the world of finance, you don't cut corners. You don't try to bend the law to suit your own financial needs. You don't treat finance as simply a means of getting wealthy. You also treat it as a means of helping companies do better, helping the American system function better. After all, the world of finance before, let's say, 25 years ago was a world that was much – well, it was a boring world, but it was a world that was much more respectable than it has become. And without Warren Buffett there, I mean, even if it weren't for this potential or I think tarnishing somewhat scandal, Warren Buffett is not going to be with us forever. And it's not clear who takes his place. You've said this already, Tom. There's just – it's amazing. There's nobody on Wall Street. There's nobody in finance I can think of, or I think that, Roger, I'd be interested in whether you can think of anybody, who has the integrity – that Warren does.
Roger Lowenstein, there's this sense that in these last 3 years, acutely, and maybe for some time before that, the people in this country, and it's an awful lot of them who have not been in on the game, their support for the system has become kind of tenuous. And Buffett may have had a critical role, actually, in reaching out and saying, there's still integrity here, you know, hang in there. If not him, who?
You know, I agree with the caller or the Facebook writer mm-hmm. who said, look, he's still far better than most. But I also agree with the premise of your question. You know, in the U.S., we used to have a savior fixation with J.P. Morgan, way back a century ago. Whenever there was a crisis or meltdown, Morgan would come in, round up a few banks and save the system. And in recent years, that's been transferred over to Warren Buffett. I think it's sort of dangerous. I think we really need to reform the whole system so that, you know, gee, is it too much to wish for that all of Wall Street would operate cleanly, not to put all our faith in that someone who we might imagine to be close to perfect will save us every time we get in trouble? Because I think whenever you expect someone is close to perfect, it's putting an impossible expectation on them. And you know, an example of that at Berkshire, Buffett, as you say, is 80. People are fixated on his succession. At any other big board company, there'd be a public process for picking the CEO. At this point, the names would be publicized. Most likely, the successor would be public. In fact, most likely, the CEO would have resigned. And Buffett has merely said that he's got a name written down in his top desk drawer and has sort of been allowed to get away with that because he's Warren Buffett. And I think what this example tells us is, as fabulous as he is, and he is fabulous, we really need him, and he needs to live by the same rules as do other CEOs.
Robert Reich, in a funny way, this goes not just to finance, but to our social fabric here. We've got listeners. Here's one listener online saying, Buffett and Gates, Bill Gates, I mean, this listener writes, don't hold much relevance to 95% of Americans. The illusion that through hard work we can become them is harmful. I mean, call it illusion, call it motivator. The idea of, you know, hard work, honest work, and you get ahead has been absolutely central to holding this country's kind of system, broad stroke, together. Bob, I think Warren Buffett's had a piece, a kind of important role in that, and here he goes.
Yes, I agree with you, Tom. I think there, over the last few years, there's been an enormous cynicism overcoming the American population, not only about Wall Street, but about the entire system of getting ahead, the assumption that we could go from rags to riches, that anybody could make it, that it was possible for the talented or the industrious or the ambitious to do almost anything. Suddenly, for many Americans, the game seems rigged, and Wall Street and finance seem to be at the center of that rigged game. Warren Buffett was the one symbol that kept on reassuring people and say, well, now, wait a minute, the game is not necessarily rigged. I do represent the old idea of integrity in finance, in the system. But without Warren, I honestly don't know where we can look to avoid a kind of a deep cynicism about the system of financial capitalism as a whole.
We may be there already. Let's go to our listeners. Mike in Essex Junction, Vermont. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. First of all, my name is Mike Armstrong. I live in Essex Junction, Vermont. I am a Berkshire Hathaway shareholder. I think that you completely have to blame Sokol for this. It's a question of very bad timing. The fact that he would buy tens of thousands of shares in a company, then recommend it to the Berkshire Hathaway board, and casually forget to mention that he had just done so is unforgivable. He had tried to quit twice before, and one would assume that Warren talked him out of it. I wouldn't imagine that Warren talked him out of it this time.
Well, so in fairness, he did mention, Warren Buffett says he did mention that he owned shares in it, but not when he bought them or how many he had.
Yeah,
how do you feel as a shareholder, Mike?
That's pretty spacey. I don't know that you can blame him for doing that. That's probably his right. I'm not an expert on insider trading rules, but it's certainly a question of deplorable timing, and you have to blame Sokol, not Warren Buffett. I don't think Warren Buffett deserves to be tarnished for this at all.
Mike, I appreciate it. Certainly, it's better for your shares if he's not. Sokol's out now. But Roger, I mean, there's a phrase for this. I think it's called front running. When you get out in front and buy shares in something, you know that a big buyer, in this case, your own company, is going to come in and jump on.
He didn't think Sokol did anything wrong or illegal. I can't remember which, but I'm not ready to exonerate him so quickly. He bought shares, I believe, the day before he went to Citigroup and said, yes, Berkshire would be interested in. The relevant question, Tom, is if you were a shareholder of Lubrizol, of this company, would you think it was interesting news that they were going to hear that Berkshire Hathaway was interested in buying them? And obviously the answer is yes, meaning that was material information. Well, if he was in possession of material information and buying first a few hundred thousand dollars worth and then shortly after $10 million worth of the stock while being in possession of material information relating to that stock, I'm not so ready to say it was okay.
Or if you're
I think the authorities are not so ready either. I think they're going to look at this very hard, and Mr. Sokol is going to have rack up quite a few legal bills before this is over.
That's interesting. On the other hand, if you're just a Berkshire Hathaway shareholder, how do you know that he's recommending the right buy here when he's got such a big personal stake in it? That could easily cloud his recommendation about what's coming. I mean, Robert Reich, you can really get hung up on the ethical nuances here, and they're big, they're important, and may even involve the law. But it seems like the more important question is, who's going to stand up for kind of a clean, upright system, if not Warren Buffett? Whether over this, the Sokol issue, or, you know, he's 80, he's not there forever, it is kind of wild that we don't have somebody in the wings who stands for that, Bob.
Well, not only that, Tom, but the real feeling, I think, out in the country about the game being rigged is that there's so many insiders who have so much information and can profit on that information that other people, small investors, don't have. And so, in a sense, David Sokol, whether it's technically legal or illegal, is beside the point. The integrity of the system depends upon what Warren Buffett used to stand for, and maybe he still does, and that is avoiding those conflicts of interest, avoiding the appearance of impropriety, avoiding what looks to everybody like insider trading. Because once that line is breached, reduce the public's confidence that the insiders are not making out like bandits, then the public, the small investor, the average person who has a little bit of savings, there are not that many out there anymore, but the average person has a little bit of savings, wants to invest those savings, just says, well, what's the point?
Roger Lowenstein, who recently wrote, one of the biggest threats to American democracy is inequality, he said. When people lose faith in that system, he's saying, we're in trouble. Let's go to James in Springfield, Missouri. James, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you know?
Great show.
Thank you.
I was just regarding Warren Buffett's sterling reputation. Wasn't it tarnished whenever Moody's sold ratings for those toxic assets as AAA?
Well, it's a good point. Roger Lowenstein, let me come to you. I mean, here, the sainted Warren Buffett, but he's a big shareholder or owner of Moody's, which got a lot of flack for its role in, you know, signing off on subpar investments.
You know, it's a good question, but I think there's a distinction there with a difference. Berkshire was an investor in Moody's, and they profited when Moody's stock went up and, and then were hurt when Moody's stock fell. And Buffett was asked publicly about Moody's, specifically Moody's abysmal failure to rate these toxic mortgage securities accurately. And he basically ducked. It was a very weak answer. The difference between that case and this case is Berkshire was an outside passive investor in Moody's. They're free to buy the stock or sell the stock in Moody's like anybody else. Buffett's really not responsible for the behavior of Moody's.
Was it a big shareholder in Moody's, Roger? Was it a major shareholder?
It was a major shareholder, but it was an outside shareholder.
Yeah.
And but the difference in this case is David Sokol is an executive of Berkshire Hathaway. Buffett is very much responsible, and going to what the other caller said before, shouldn't we blame this all on Sokol? Well, yes, except for the old Harry Truman phrase, you know, the buck stops there, right? Buffett really is responsible for everything that his senior executives do. So I think this is a much more troubling case than the Moody's case.
But it's interesting, Bob Reich, I mean, I think our caller's got his finger on something here, though Warren Buffett has been held up as a sterling example of the big successful investor with integrity. He's also been deeply inside this system, and in some ways he's come out and given it, you know, the sort of a shroud of credibility when nobody else could. He's saved its bacon.
Yes, and indeed, Tom. I mean, when you look at what the role of Warren Buffett was in helping Wall Street, I mean, even over the last 3 years, I mean, Goldman Sachs needed Warren Buffett's imprimatur. His seal of approval. I mean, interestingly, if you look at the investment that Warren Buffett made in Goldman Sachs compared to the loan or the bailout that American taxpayers provided Goldman Sachs, I mean, Warren Buffett did much, much better than American taxpayers. He got an equity stake. I think at some point historians are going to look back and say, well, why exactly didn't Tim Geithner insist when it came to the government and taxpayers getting a stake in Goldman Sachs? Why didn't he insist on an equity stake for us as well? But let me just say something more general, and that is that so much profit on Wall Street has been captured, and so much profit by American corporations has been captured by hedge funds and private equity funds and aggressive merger and acquisition shops and electronic traders, that the average investor, even if it had not been for the meltdown or near meltdown of Wall Street over the last few years, the average investor really is very distrustful now, almost doesn't want to get back into the market. And it's Warren Buffett's voice that has been so powerful and so important in telling the average investor it's okay. You can go back. You know, I'm going back. I don't have an active investment interest. I'm going back. You can join me. That's what we're talking about. When that voice of integrity is either no longer there because Warren is getting very old and he's not going to be there forever, or when he is tainted by something like David Sokol's trading, then the small investor already worried about Wall Street's integrity is going to be worried even further.
We're thinking about how all this holds together with Robert Reich and Roger Lowenstein. Joe in Jamestown, Rhode Island is calling. Hi, Joe. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah,
I'd like to just contribute from a perspective where, Warren has done some unbelievable things from an investment perspective, and there he has to be honored. But I think from a societal perspective, to think that, you know, this is a beacon that we all seek. Now, Warren has skin in the game, and every time Warren gives input, he's had some vested interest. Bob mentioned earlier the issue with regards to Goldman. Warren did that deal in preferred stock, and you got a 10% rate of return on that preferred issue.
And we should just remind people that this is when Goldman Sachs really needed a lifeline in that full-on market panic back in 2008, and he ponied up $5 billion, which was a lot of money for them, but also sort of laying on the Warren Buffett touch there to help them out, and he did it in a way that's redounded very profitably to himself.
That's correct. And to speak to that specifically, he gave an interview with Charlie Rose, mm-hmm. with regards to that transaction. Simultaneously, the government was in the midst of doing the same, but the government's terms at multiples much greater than Warren's capital investment were at terms of not 10%, but 5%, and Warren told the world that that was a good deal for the U.S. taxpayer, but yet his deal was much better. And I think the other issues with regards to that as a guidance to society, and whether it's from an investment perspective or socially, I think we need to stop looking to individuals who are looking to be capitalists as guidance in that capacity and recognize that that comes at a risk because Warren has skin in the game. If the market goes down 10%, we were just quoted what Berkshire's share price was earlier in the program.
Yep.
And so if that goes down 10%, that's a major loss to Berkshire and its shareholders. So Warren has a vested interest to keep those prices up, contrary to perhaps what reality is, either in the economy or in the standard of living for people.
No, Joe, it's a good point. And clearly he's got skin in the game, a lot of skin in the game. But if it's, but you know, it's it may maybe it's too much to follow individuals. On the other hand, people take cues from individuals. And Warren Buffett's been very important in giving cues to the American public for a long time now about the integrity of a system that has looked awfully wobbly sometimes. I mean, if it's not him giving those cues, then who, Joe?
Well, I think, Tom, I think the issue for the American society is let it begin with me. Americans need to recognize that they need to trust their own judgment and not necessarily the judgment from outside for guidance. And I think ultimately that'll be the best beacon that will serve them and their family.
Joe, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here, if I may, from Boston. Tom is calling. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to say, I mean, they're all excellent comments, but I also think, you know, this all sounds great. He seems like a folksy guy. But what about the United States and all the people? He's rode a wave of financialism in this country, not capitalism. He's left behind him and all the rest of these Wall Street people have left behind an absolute devastated economy with working people very worried about their future, their children's future, Social Security and Medicare. And it just seems less of a country, economically at least, today than it was in 1968. And why should we be worshiping or, you know, worshiping this guy who's a billionaire? What is he saying about free trade and NAFTA and GATT and all the agreements that are absolutely dismantling this country, the ability of people to get jobs, to build a better future, to amass their own capital as a family or an individual? And I'll take my comment off the air, but I think there's very little to admire about him in the sense that if you put anything in the market in 1968, 40 or 50 years later, you would have done just as well. And he seems like a nice folksy guy, but what are we left with?
Yep.
If he's a leader, he should be speaking out against that.
Tom, let us pick it up right there. Of course, there's doing well and doing well, and you're getting right toward Robert Reich's wheelhouse here. We'll come to Bob Reich, but let me come to you first, Roger Lowenstein here. I mean, you hear the complaint. I mean, you've written recently about the dangers to democracy of inequality. Our caller Tom saying, you know, Warren Buffett represents a kind of financialism. Certainly, we've seen inequality grow a lot during those years when he's been one of the biggest, become one of the biggest investors in the country. Does he have some responsibility there, Roger?
Yes, I do. I think he does, and frankly, I think he's carried it out, fulfilled it for the most part. Firstly, his wealth has come because the value of his company has grown. It doesn't come because he's paid himself a big salary. He's never collected more than $100,000 a year. It doesn't come from stock options, because he's never taken one. And speaking, I think, more directly to the caller's point, Warren has been really almost uniquely out front among mega billionaires and saying, look, taxes should be more progressive in this country. We should have an inheritance tax. People like me should not be able to pass much of their wealth on to their kids or whatever. It should go back to society. The companies he's invested in have thrived so that, you know, people have jobs and so on. So I don't think that it's quite fair when the charge of financialism, I think, is a good charge to lay at Wall Street. But when I hear that, I think of these, you know, stock options, obscene sorts of gains, these CEOs who collect 60, 70 million in a single year, and then some of them year after year. But that's not how Warren has gotten rich. I think he's met that responsibility for the most part.
Robert Reich, help us parse this. He has indeed steered away from a lot of the greedy straight grabs for the dough that we've seen on Wall Street. On the other hand, our caller Tom says this is a time where a lot of things have happened, and he points to financialism as the reason, that have not turned out to be so great for millions of Americans.
Well, it's an irony here, Tom, because it may be that Warren Buffett, even though, and I agree with Roger entirely, has stood for overcoming inequality and being more responsible as an investor sector, as a financial sector, the importance of a more progressive income tax, a lot of issues and a lot of positions that are not often taken by the captains of American industry. In fact, he has been one of the contrarians with regard to coming out very forcefully about the lopsidedness of income distribution in this country. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, having a kind of he's almost the Walter Cronkite of American capitalism, if I'm not dating myself by
great
saying
praise,
that.
Bob. Great praise, Bob.
But by having that kind of man of integrity reassuring people, are we not kind of masking the overwhelming dominance of financial capitalism over product capitalism? What's happened over the last 30 years? American workers basically facing flat wages or declining wages, unions being busted up, corporations becoming global, outsourcing. And above all, the financial sector of the economy pushing all of this, saying you've got to maximize shareholder earnings and no other value, community or worker or any other value is as important. Are we not kind of and have we not kind of allowed Warren Buffett to be the apologist for American capitalism in a certain sense?
And it's funny, even as he's been a contrarian, in another sense. I'll come to you on that, Roger. Let me get a call here, if I may. Scott in Wakefield, Massachusetts. Scott, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I would just like to make an observation. Some years ago, Mr. Buffett took a very large stake in the Gillette Company.
Gillette shaving products,
Back around 10 years ago, mm-hmm. he brought in a fellow named Kiltz, allegedly to restructure the company to make it more profitable. Mr. Kiltz, and I believe it was on Mr. Buffett's behalf, stated that there was no intent to sell the company. Now, correct me if I am wrong here, but I believe that later turned out that Mr. Kiltz began to market the company almost as soon as he became the CEO. So my question here is, how does this square with Mr. Buffett's alleged honorable moral behavior?
Were you working for Gillette back in the day, Scott?
I was.
And did you end up seeing Warren Buffett as a capitalist savior or something else?
Initially, we thought he was a savior. He was going to prevent the company from being taken over and perhaps broken up. But in the end, due to the statements that were made about that Mr. Kiltz had made, I believe Mr. Buffett's any respect I had for him as far as his morality is concerned vanished.
Scott, I appreciate your call. Roger Lowenstein, there's somebody who may have felt the sort of stinging end of Warren Buffett's investment strategy. I don't know. What about this? There's a particular, and at the same time, the concern on the table that admirable as he may be in so many ways, philanthropy and all the rest, he's been part of a system that is undercut as much as it may have grown.
Look, the title of my book on Buffett was The Making of an American Capitalist,
yep.
Not social worker or philanthropist. And, he doesn't turn down a good price. It didn't in the case of Gillette. And I was thinking of when Bob's raised a very valid point, is has it become the apologist for capitalism? I was thinking back to when Buffett closed down the original Berkshire Hathaway textile plant, which was, as I recall, in the early 70s. And it kept the plant going on for probably more years than other people would have. He didn't want to close it, but
yep.
It was obvious that the textile business economically had moved to Asia and it wasn't profitable, didn't want to put any more capital to it, and so forth. And he wrote in his annual letter that it had been torn between his Karl Marx side, that was the side supposedly that was standing up for the workers, and his Adam Smith side. That was his side, obviously, that didn't want to throw more capital away, more of a shareholder's capital. in a dying business. I have to say that I thought then, I think now, that is between the two, Warren Buffett has always kept his Karl Marx side rather well hidden, and he's a capitalist. And yes, he got a better deal for Berkshire than in those investments during the crash in 2008 than Hank Paulson got for the U.S. taxpayers. I asked Paulson about that. He said, look, I wanted to make a profit for the taxpayers, but I also wanted the banks to do well because we were trying to revive the banks. Now, you can like that or not, but Buffett had only one interest when he invested in Goldman Sachs. He was trying to maximize the profit for Berkshire Hathaway. And if you think he's trying to do otherwise, you know, then I think you sanctify someone who shouldn't be sanctified. He's a very good capitalist, but he's not a saint.
And there you're writing The Making of an American Capitalist, and what, 10, 15 years later, writing The End of Wall Street. The End of Wall Street. I don't know about the sequence of that, Roger, but it certainly gives us a lot to think about as this guy who has put such a particular face on American capitalism comes at 80 into a rough patch here. I'm really grateful to each of you for being with us today. Roger Lowenstein, author of Buffett and The End of Wall Street, joining us from Cordoba, Spain today, no less. Thank you very much for being with us, Roger.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure, both of you, to be on the show.
And Robert Reich, author of Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Always great to have you with us. Thank you so much, Bob.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.